Welcome to the Legal Academy, a podcast about law professors. I'm your host, Oren Kerr, a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. This is an interview-based show in which I'll interview leading law professors about the Legal Academy. We'll cover topics like legal scholarship, teaching law, university service, and everything else that law professors think about. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Legal Academy, episode 14. I'm your host, Oren Kerr. My guest this week is Beth Walensky, clinical professor of law at the Legal Practice Program at the University of Michigan Law School, where she has been a faculty member since 2003. Before that, she was an associate at the litigation section of Akin Gump. She has written widely in areas of legal research and legal education, and recently joined the board of the Journal of Legal Communication and Rhetoric. Beth, it's so great to have you on the show to talk about legal writing programs.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks, Oren.
Great. So let's get started. What do you see as the role of legal writing programs in law school? And imagine this is something that has changed somewhat over time. Going back decades ago, my sense is that legal writing programs were not a major focus of legal education. They've very much become more of so. Give us kind of the vision of how legal writing programs fit into legal education.
Yeah, so I can kind of start with where we are today, and then we can kind of do a little bit of the history. So I think the first thing to know is that, if you think about sort of what some people call podium professors versus non-podium professors, right? So the people who are sort of in the more traditional legal path to academia, if you ask sort of what they do and what their job is like, you kind of have a sense that it's pretty consistent across law schools. When it comes to legal writing, that's actually not true. The makeup of the programs, the way that faculty get hired into the programs, the job expectations, all of those things might change and might look very different from one law school to another. But generally, it's true, I think, to think about the role of legal writing programs, to think of them in a couple different ways. One, just with respect to the curriculum of the law school, right? So if we think of writing as the lawyer's stock in trade, which I think most people, who have more than a passing familiarity with the legal profession, right? As long as it doesn't come from watching Law and Order, most people who know anything about practicing law know that writing is the probably the bulk of what most lawyers do. So obviously we should be teaching students that skill. And when I talk about writing, I mean writing in its most expansive sense, right? Like the legal analysis, thinking, organization, research that goes into it, of course, all the style and grammar, things like that. And in fact, I think the thinking piece of it is really important. So a lot of people like to say that law school teaches you to think like a lawyer, and anybody who writes for a living probably knows that having to put words on the page is sort of intimately related to the thinking process, right? You can't really divorce those two things. So when we teach students legal writing, we are sort of forcing them to do a lot of the legal thinking, right? The thinking like a lawyer. So here's just like a quick example, right? When I teach students sort of how to describe a case. This is a very sort of like early in the year, fundamental, like what I call case explanation, right? You've kind of set up an element of a test and you want to give some examples, right? So one of the things we're trying to do is figure out what words do you need on the page so that somebody who hasn't read the case can understand it. But also we're really trying to figure out what facts from this case are important for the point that you're trying to make. So this is something that students talk about a lot in all of their classes, right? When you have a professor who kind of throws out a hypothetical and what if we tweak it a little bit, now what is the outcome? When we do that, engage in that activity in a legal writing class, we're doing the same kind of thinking, but forcing students to put it down on paper, now get some thinking about which are the legally significant facts. And then we can talk about how attorneys and judges might disagree on what the legally significant facts are of this case. And one, side might say, well, this is a really important case. And the other side says, actually, it's distinguishable for these reasons. So that's just sort of one example. So that's kind of where we sit in the curriculum. And then I think about sort of where legal writing programs fit, what their role is in law schools with respect to the student experience. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is closely related to the curriculum piece. I had a student a few years ago who I think I got, this is probably the best comment I've ever gotten from a student in all my years of teaching. And this one, it came in, it must've been in an email and not in a course evaluation, because I know who the student is. I'm going to use the gender neutral singular they to refer to the student. So as not to reveal really anything about their background, except that I can tell you this, they were from an undergraduate institution that is, I don't know that we'd ever had a student from this school before, right? It's not one of the like elite institutions. And they had done okay first semester, struggled in most of their 1L classes, had done a perfectly adequate job in my class when we do predictive writing first semester. And then second semester, when we make the shift to persuasive writing, like a fair number of students, this student just like knocked it out of the park, right? Like some students really, when you give them like a position to advocate for and even an imaginary client, right? They just get it. And so I had been, you know, all semester been telling this student how good their work was and explaining why, right? Like, and at the end of the semester, after the school year ended, I get an email from the student that says, thank you. Your class is the only thing that made me feel like I belonged here. Hmm. And I know from talking to lots of students that that's not an extraordinarily uncommon feeling, right? In other words, plenty of students are fine, right, with the Socratic method, with the cold call. Lots of students do not shine in that environment. And when they enter law school their first year and most of their classes are on that kind of model, we're sending a message to our students that this is what it takes to be a successful lawyer, right? Like being able to excel in that kind of class environment. And we know that that's not true, right? This student I know is going to be an amazing, actually may already be, you've got to remember exactly when they graduated, right? An amazing attorney, right? I have no question at all about that. But you know, we in the legal writing class, we give our students have a lot of different ways to be smart, right? Some students who, you know, maybe aren't great at answering questions in class, but if you sit down next to them with a piece of writing that they light up. Some students really good at writing. Some students maybe struggle with writing, but gosh, if you give them a research topic, like they're the ones who think huge strategic thoughts about it and then dig deep and find like the gem that everybody else missed. Every year I have students who struggle with various parts of the class and then stand up to give an oral argument on a summary judgment assignment and like blow me out of the water, right? So one of the nice things is there are lots of different ways for students to show and to feel successful. And I think my class in particular, legal writing classes, give them that opportunity. So I wonder if we...
One thing you mentioned, there were a range of different approaches to legal writing programs. Can you kind of give us an overview to the... Obviously, it's hard to know what every other school's doing, but like what are the different approaches that different schools might take?
So first we can talk maybe about the similarities. Most schools will start out usually first semester with what we call predictive writing, right? Like, you know, sort of the fundamentals of legal analysis, writing and research. How do you take a bunch of cases, for example, figure out, try to predict what a court might do in a particular situation. And then second semester usually shift to persuasive writing. Some of us incorporate transactional skills. Almost every school does some sort of oral argument. Some schools have a third semester of required legal writing. Michigan is not one of those. In some instances, so Michigan individual legal practice faculty have a tremendous amount of discretion and flexibility and autonomy in what and how we teach. So I write all my own problems. We're very collaborative. Like we talk to each other all the time and bounce each ideas off of each other and sometimes, you know, borrow each other's materials. But at other law schools, things are much more lockstep. It's much more coordinated for various reasons. At some of those schools, it's because they switch at the semester. And so students will have one professor first semester and a different professor second semester. And so they want to have some consistency in what and how they're teaching. At some schools, it's, you know, really the program is the classes are taught by adjuncts, right? Who come in, teach a class, go back to their day jobs, those schools tend to be ones where you've got a director who writes pretty much all of the material and, you know, gives it to the faculty, the adjuncts. And then another big way that, you know, difference is just in sort of the role and the status of faculty, of legal writing faculty, you know, sort of relative to the rest of the faculty.
No, there are a lot of great issues to talk about there. One is, maybe I'm just familiar with schools that have had the adjunct model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when I was in law school, you know, we had the sort of like the third year students were the adjuncts, and there wasn't a lot of teaching that actually
went. Yeah, I think you and I think we overlapped in law school, right?
I think
we
did. Yeah. So it was, you know, my impression, at least in the experience, was like, oh, I guess there was a legal writing program a little bit. But, you know, fortunately, institutions where I have been afterwards have taken it vastly more seriously, and increasingly so, I think, rightly so. But like, if it's not adjunct professors, who is it? Because I guess the nature of it is it's intensive one-on-one.
So one of the big differences between legal writing classes and sort of the other classes that students take throughout most of law school is that a huge amount of the teaching we do takes place outside the classroom, right? Like, my students write a lot of things for me. Everything they write, they get a very detailed set of written feedback from me. And then I have around 40 students a year, and I meet with them individually 4 to 5 times each semester for anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour, depending on where we are in the semester and what we're talking about. So we can talk about the draft they're working on or where they are in their research process. I give them a lot of feedback. They go, they do a rewrite. They get a whole other set of feedback from me. So yeah, very, very time consuming, which is why if you're in the adjunct programs, they tend to be, you have a smaller group of students. You maybe have, you know, between 12 and 18 students. And then you're trying to fit that, you know, sort of individual student facing work into your work day, which is, I know from talking to people that it's quite challenging. So those are the adjunct programs, the sort of the model that you and I both kind of experienced in law school with the two L's. And actually, here's a funny story, the confession. When I was in law school at the end of my first, I don't remember what the program was called, right? But there was a name for the program for those.
Introduction to Lawyering.
But the organization for the students who were like taught the 2Ls and 3Ls.
Oh, was it Board of Student Advisors?
Yeah,
ESA. Okay. This is like Harvard in the 1990s, in case you're wondering what the context is.
So I applied to teach legal writing at the end of my first year and was not selected. So apparently I was not no one was qualified to teach legal writing, but I was even less qualified than my classmates. And so here I am, right? 20 some odd years later, 22 years later. At any rate, so you've got like the programs that have a director and, you know, have adjuncts. Then you've got programs, you know, so then in terms of the people who teach it full time, there's still quite a range of things like, you know, sort of your role in the faculty. Are you, and your job security, right? Like, so when I started at Michigan, for example, and Michigan was one of the first schools in, you know, the top tier of the U.S. News and World Reports to sort of thing, to actually shift to hiring full-time legal writing faculty. In fact, Michigan used to have like the model where 2Ls and 3Ls taught it. And then in 1995, 96, they switched to, and they hired full-time legal practice faculty on 2-year contracts, right? They thought people were going to come in, teach for 2 years, and then you're going to go back to your, you know, practicing law. Which is still a model that I think some schools and some big cities use. You know, like there's, and what ended up happening over time is that Michigan realized, first of all, those of us who ended up teaching here, and I joined the program, as you said, in 2003, loved teaching, right? Loved Michigan, that helps, loved Ann Arbor. And the school realized that it actually is really, really good to have people who are fully invested in this as their career. Right? Like just as, you know, for anything else, like, you know, like I sort of spend my whole professional life thinking about what is good legal writing, what is good legal analysis, what is good legal research, and how do you teach those things to law students, right? And it turns out that the program is much better and the students get a lot more out of it when you have people who, you know, whose professional lives revolve around, you know, thinking about those things. So what has happened over time at Michigan, and this has also happened at law schools generally, is that we have, the school has done more to grant us, you know, sort of longer term contracts. I'm now on a 7-year contract, which is presumptively renewable. It's like the closest that at Michigan that we get to, that the legal writing faculty gets to tenure. You know, I vote on everything except for like hiring and promotion of like the tenure track faculty, right? But I participate in all of those, except for the tenure meetings. I participate in all the hiring meetings. I'm one of the few people on the experiential side who, when we have people come through, both entry level and lateral candidates for job talks, like I read their paper, I go to the small group interviews, I ask questions about the paper. I always ask a question about their teaching if I can. I don't think you should go to interview at any law school anywhere without being asked at least once about your teaching, and hopefully more than once. Or if you spend the whole day talking about the scholarship.
Is that an important part of the job?
Some of those things are right. I mean, in Michigan, the culture is very much like once you're here, like this is not a school where, you know, you can phone it in with your teaching, no matter what you're teaching. So I think it's also good to sort of telegraph to job candidates that, yeah, we care about this sort of.
One thing I wanted to go back to something you said a minute ago, which was sort of the different approaches to legal writing in the first year, or different ways of teaching the material. Yeah. And for those of us that are outsiders to this, are there sort of different schools of thought of the best way to present it? Does it sort of fall into different camps essentially, or is there more of an agreement on those sort of fundamental questions?
I think there's probably a lot of agreement on a lot of the fundamental questions, right? At the margins and on sort of individual teaching decisions, there are a lot of differences. Again, you know, partly because, you know, we have a huge amount of material that we would love to cover in the course of a year, and there's no way you can get it all in. And so different people will make different decisions. Some people do more oral argument, some people do client interviewing, some people do transactional, right? You know, there are, you know, some people take different approaches to individual pieces. For example, I have a set of conferences where I do what's called live grading, where students come in with something that I haven't seen yet, and I read it in front of them, and I comment on it, and I ask them questions. Some people think that that's great. I actually think it works really well for one conference, maybe two conferences of the year, just for students to see how someone reacts to their writing when they haven't read it yet. Some people think, no, you should always, you know, give full written feedback, and like, I'll do that on the rewrite. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the fundamentals that we do, I think, are pretty uniform, right? The gold standard is a low enough number of students that you can do lots of sustained, detailed written feedback, write, feedback, rewrite, write, feedback, rewrite. You know, my approach, you know, maybe I know that this differs a little bit from colleagues at other schools, like, I cement a lot of the fundamentals early so that then we can have fun and do like different things. Right, not that the fundamentals aren't fun, but when I think back to my experience learning legal writing, like it was basically like, here's IRAC, here's the formula you should use, that's it, right? I basically get through that in like the first month, and I really cement, I use a different acronym. Everyone's got their own acronym. I use one called CREAC. They're all versions of the same thing. I like want to cement that early so they understand what some of the building blocks of legal analysis are and why those are the building blocks. And then we can start mixing them up, right? Then we can talk about what happens when you have a question that doesn't fit into this organization, other principles of organization that we've learned, right? So I do a lot of like, get the fundamentals out of the way, but I don't want you to be wedded to them. And I also, and I think this is probably pretty true, I focus a ton on process, right? It's really not about what product are you producing. It's like sort of teaching and helping students sort of become lifelong learners and people who view legal writing as something that takes a lifetime to master. Just, you know, like I look back at stuff that I wrote 10 years ago and I kind of get a little cringy about it. Because I find all sorts of things I would have done differently now, right? Like if you're constantly reflecting and getting better and learning, then I want them to walk out of the class at the end of the year with that idea. So, you know, again, some of these things, people take slightly different approaches, but I think the fundamentals of what makes for a good approach are probably not going to change that much among schools where there's a professionalized legal writing faculty.
And is there a standard practice in terms of how many credits the program will be, and if it's graded versus I have, you know, I was at one institution where it started off as a credit, no credit, some variation of that, and then switched to graded. And is there a standard sort of way that that's done, or if not, one that you think is best?
So those are two great questions. So the first one's easy, right? Is there a standard? And no, right? So the number of credits varies at Michigan. It's a year-long course. It's 5 credits. And it's, you know, I think that you can't do a half credit. So I think it's 3 and 2, but we tell our students to think of it as 2.5 and 2.5. And at some schools, it's more credits than that. We have a modified pass-fail program at Michigan. At other schools, it's graded, you know, on whether it should be graded or not. There are deep divisions about this. I think that there are real benefits to having it not graded. I really encourage my students to collaborate a lot, to talk with each other about the motion, the memo, the arguments, the research, the whatever, the citation, frankly, right? And I don't know that I would get as much benefit out of that collaboration outside of class if it was graded, especially if it was graded on a curve. Yeah. I want students to take risks, to try out an argument that, I mean, they're 1Ls. Like, they don't know if this is a good argument or not. They don't know if this is going to apply or not, right? Like, go ahead and try it, and then we'll talk about it. We'll kind of, you know, sometimes we'll even, like, bring it into class, and I'll give you the chance to ask the, you know, 18 other really, really smart 1Ls in the class. Like, what do you think of this introduction? Did I go overboard? Like, was it too much? Was it not enough? So I like the non-graded approach from that perspective, but I appreciate that for some students, especially students who work really hard and really, you know, not just work hard, but to, you know, produce really, really great work, that they feel like it's not necessarily reflected in the grade. Although we do have about 20% of students who get honors. You know, interestingly enough, we did a survey a few years ago of our teaching assistants in the program to just ask them, among other questions, like, do you think that the class should be graded? And this is a group. Students, maybe 40 students, who all did very well in the class as they got hired as teaching assistants. And surprisingly, they were pretty split on whether they thought it should be graded or not. So I have colleagues who feel very strongly it should be graded. You know, I think one of the things that I noticed, you know, is when we went last year with the COVID, you know, sort of pandemic, when we went, everybody went pass fail, which didn't make much difference in my class, is that my students still worked really hard, whether it's graded or not, whether honors were available or not.
Yeah, it does seem, just in sort of past institutions where I've been, where we've had this debate, you know, students are going to work really hard in the legal writing program because they recognize how fundamental it is and how important it is mm-hmm. to actual practice. I mean, that's the one that really matters. And then it became a question of, is it fair to ask students to work that much without then also having them be rewarded for it, with then all the downsides, I guess, which you were alluding to, of, you know, the competitive nature mm-hmm. of a curved 1L class where the, you know, two students are going to get an A, and then it just sort of makes it a bit more cutthroat than you'd want. But is there a more common answer? Is it usually pass fail?
So I think this is again where you see differences roughly, but not exclusively, based, that you could probably divide it a little bit by sort of the rankings of the law school. At most law schools, I would say it probably does get a grade. You know, Michigan is certainly not alone in not doing a graded approach.
Interesting. So I wanted to talk about hiring mm-hmm. professors in the field. So one of the challenges that I've talked about in prior episodes is, like, if you are in a position of voting as mm-hmm. an outsider on whether to hire someone in a field you know nothing about, how do you do that? And in legal writing programs, I think it's a particularly strong problem. Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
What should the podium professors, who have no idea how these programs are actually working, what should they be looking for, other than just deferring to the other people in the legal writing program?
I love the term podium professor, but I'm also amused. I mean, like, I appreciate that, like, it's not like, because we used to call, people would say doctrinal versus non-doctrinal. It turns out legal writing is actually quite doctrinal, so that's not a good distinction. But I've watched enough of my colleagues teach to know that even the podium professors tend to, you know, walk up and down the aisles and circulate the room. Anyways,
yes.
So yeah, so what do I mean? So here's what I think is essential. One, I mean, just sort of the fundamentals. You've got to have like real deep practice experience, right? So when I joined the faculty, so among the many changes over the 17 or 18 years I've been on the faculty, one of them is, and I know that I've watched enough of the Indies interviews that you've done with other people to know that this is not unique to legal writing. Like, I don't think I would be hired today, right? If I had just those credentials that I had back then, right? Whatever the equivalent is of like, you know, like the VAP and the PhD on the podium side, right? Like I don't have that. I had 5 years of practice experience under my belt. And the only teaching I had done was in law school. I was a teaching fellow for an undergraduate course, which was a great experience, but didn't really prepare me, you know, teach legal writing. So really good practice experience, right? And more than just 3 or 4 years. I think 5 years is preference, sort of my preference for the minimum. But if you have more than that, if you have more than that in multiple areas, all that much better, but it's hard to do that, right? But like my ideal candidate would have practiced a little bit in crim and some civil and maybe, you know, had a clerkship and done some government work, right? But no one's gonna have all of those different things inside of, you know, even 8 or 10 years, and that's fine. And then, you know, and this is where it's kind of like, I'm going to say what my ideal is, and then I want to recognize that I don't want to discourage candidates, right, from trying this. But like at Michigan, when we hire, we have a pretty competitive applicant pool, so we tend to be able to look only at people who already have teaching experience in legal writing. And so right, that raises the question, well, how do you get teaching experience in legal writing? And we can talk about that. But for me, because the fundamental thing the thing on which we hire, promote, and retain is principally excellence in teaching, is what our standards say for legal writing. I mean, there's some other things, but in my program, the thing that certainly gets you promoted, right, first into your initial kind of 3-year contract, and then certainly onto your sort of long-term 7-year contract, is demonstrated excellence in teaching. So the more I can actually know about someone's teaching, the more I'm able to evaluate them as a candidate. So there's a couple things that are going on there. One is supervising junior attorneys in practice, certainly beneficial, but it's like there are so many differences between doing that and teaching 1Ls, right? So if you come in thinking like, oh, like I've given feedback to my junior associates or my whatever, right? Like, there are lots of ways that you have to have a very different mindset. Even if you're somebody who brings to your practice career, like I want to help develop attorneys and stuff like that, it's different, right? And the other thing is like, I can just have more conversations with a candidate who's got some teaching, right? And I get more information about their philosophy, their teaching approach, like talk to me about when you've had a student who's really struggled, right? Talk to me about the you know, when you've had a student who is outstandingly brilliant when you talk to them, but never learned how to get words on the page, right? You know, what do you do to get your students to reflect on, you know, sort of the things that you're doing so that they can take what they've learned on one assignment and use it on another? Like the depth of conversation I can have with someone who's been teaching this, and you don't even have to have a lot of teaching experience. You've had students that you've worked with to have that conversation. Because one of the other things, and you know, sort of going back and thinking about the role of legal writing faculty on faculties, is that we are, I think, more than just about anybody else, pedagogy experts, right? Which again, like my podium colleagues spend a lot of time thinking about teaching and are dedicated to being good teachers. They still spend, like we spend more time thinking about it. It's a crucial part of what we do when we go to legal writing conferences. Huge, huge, huge sort of like the volume of sort of conversations that we're having and panels we're going to. Lots of them are about the substance of legal writing and things like that and all sorts of interesting research people are doing, but lots of it is about pedagogy. We also, you know, because of the variety of things that we teach, we learn and figure out and try out and experiment with lots of different ways to teach. So again, you know, being able to talk to somebody about those kinds of things, I think is really, really useful. So then how do you get that?
Maybe we're going the same direction here, which is, so is the typical path of somebody who's interested in becoming a legal writing professor, obviously practice for a couple of years, as you said, like you get that foundation of practice. And then are there ways of sort of getting your foot in the door, sort of maybe do people become an adjunct for some period of time? And then with that experience, then go on kind of the teaching market specifically for legal writing programs where they'll have that experience? Is that
yeah.
common? Is there no one kind of common?
No, absolutely, right? So like that's one of the pieces of advice I give to students or to alums who come to me and say like, how do I break into legal writing? Is to say, well, first of all, look and see what your local law schools are doing. If they have any sort of adjunct program, definitely, you know, reach out and talk to them about that. You know, sometimes they might have even like need someone to fill in on a more sort of like a full-time basis if you have the flexibility to do that. We had a circumstance here a few years ago where we had for medical reasons, we needed to reach out to our local legal community and say like anybody interested in coming to teach. And that worked out actually very well. You know, it's not ideal, but like it was good to have we still have actually a pretty good bench of practitioners in Ann Arbor who are connected to the law school and excited to come teach legal writing. And then there are a fair number of law schools that do hire into their permanent legal writing positions from their local, practice community. So, you know, if you are able to, you know, find one of those opportunities, like that is absolutely, it's a great way into the legal writing community. This is where, again, there's huge variation among schools. It's, like I said, when I applied for this job, I saw that we were thinking of moving back to the Midwest. I saw the posting for this. We were thinking about Ann Arbor. I thought, I didn't even know that was a job that people had, again, because we had like the 2L and 3L program, but I would love to do that. I applied. They flew me out. I talked to a couple people. I talked to the director of the program. They hired me, right? Now, like, we have a hiring process that is much more robust. Like, we actually have our candidates teach a mock class. Right. So in addition to meeting with lots of people, both on the podium and, you know, experiential, non-experiential side during the day. So the whole process is much more in-depth and robust, and it's easier to navigate that process if you've got some teaching experience under your belt. But there are also lots of different ways to get exposed to the pedagogy of what we do. Right. There are journals that really produce a lot of pedagogy, everything from like newsletters with short teaching ideas to much more in-depth scholarship on cognitive science and what does it mean for how you teach adult learners. And then you can reach out to your local law schools and, you know, I want to volunteer to be a, you know, judge at your, in your mock trial, right? All those different things. There are lots of opportunities to get involved, to go speak in a class and start to kind of do those things.
You mentioned scholarship in the field of legal writing, and you're now on the board of one of the journals. Is there an expectation that legal writing professors will do scholarship generally? Is it only at some schools? Is it just something that people do because they're interested in it? What's the role of scholarship for legal writing professors?
This is maybe one of the things that varies the most across law schools. It kind of goes hand in hand with some of the status issues that I know we can talk about. But if you're teaching legal writing, you should be writing, right? Now, I don't know. My personal view is that it doesn't have to be scholarship, right? If it's still taking on cases on the side. So two of my colleagues, Margaret Hannon and Ted Becker, right, a few years ago, partnered with the ACLU and took on the sort of briefing and arguing of a pretty significant case in Michigan. It was a criminal procedure case about the police officers had a pattern and practice of like printing and photographing, you know, people they did Terry stops on, I think. And, you know, Margaret like argued it before the Michigan Supreme Court and won, right? So that, I think, you know, when you think about what do you want your legal writing faculty to be doing besides teach or in addition to teaching, I like engaging in scholarship, but there's a certain kind of scholarship that kind of feels right to me. And it's not like a 50,000 word law review article. I have colleagues across the country who do that and do that really well, and I really get excited when I read their stuff. The sweet spot for me is like, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 words on a sort of narrower topic, right? And then I do a lot of sort of, I like teaching ideas. Like, I think about pedagogy all the time. I think especially a lot about how do you engage with, students who might be skeptical of or resistant to sort of like the things that we know about what makes for, you know, good learning and things like that. And so I think a lot about that and I write in that area. So, you know, do you have to do it? There are some schools at which the standards are identical to what they are for the non-experiential faculty, right? And if you come in, you're expected to write, if you get, you know, in order to get tenure. There are some schools where they have programs where they have a unitary track, right? Where everybody's kind of on the same, like you come in and then you apply for tenure and you either get it or you don't, where there is still, I think, a sort of either tacit or explicit understanding that the things that we're looking for you to get tenure are maybe a little different. And then there are schools like Michigan where the standards are explicitly different. And the things that we are expected to do for promotion, again, like the primary thing that I get that I was evaluated on was my teaching. And then there's what they call sort of the professional, like sort of professional contributions. And it can be scholarship, it can be practicing, you know, sort of taking on significant cases. Those are kind of the two major things that people do. And so part of it from the perspective of someone who's entering the profession or wants to enter the profession is to figure out like, what do you want to do? Do you want to engage in the kind of scholarship that looks very similar to what the non-experiential faculty does? And if so, would you be okay doing that at an institution that doesn't necessarily reward it and may not even support it, right? When I say support, I mean like give, you know, sort of research money and make research, you know, sort of assistance available to you and actually think it's something that they're proud of and they want to promote and they want to, you know, do all the other things and maybe even give you time and space to do that work. You know, for me, I got into this job for the teaching. I actually prefer that is the primary thing on which I'm sort of the thing that I need to be great at. But I like doing the writing too. So I actually kind of hit the sweet spot where like I'm at an institution that, you know, sort of values the writing that I do. And again, it's, you know, it's written into our standards, which, you know, sort of gives it some teeth. So it kind of, it works out well for me, but I could imagine for other people who don't want to do any of the scholarship, right? It's not the right place for them, or people who really want to do a lot more and, you know, sort of, it might not be the right place for them either.
Okay. Interesting. So I wanted to turn to the issue of status that you mentioned. So this comes up a lot in my experience with, in the legal writing community. And a few years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, I was on a panel at the AALS that was like explicitly on this. And I was one of the, I guess we're calling it podium, whatever, the doctrinal professors who was sort of brought in without, you know, there were a lot of people very critical of the status quo. We were debating. It was actually a fabulous discussion. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But I did want, it is, I think, a really difficult question that, you know, and I guess the critique that I heard a lot, you know, we are second class citizens. We are not given the same level of status. We are not given the same pay. We are not given the same tenure options and that needs to end. How should we think about those questions?
Yeah. So I think so. Two things are true, right? One, I think it is unquestionably true that there has been a huge sort of like forward progress, is sort of in terms of the status of legal writing faculty. Certainly in the almost 20 years I've been in the academy, but you know, starting you know much before then. Thanks in large part to the hard work that many of the earliest legal writing, you know, people who sort of like were hired, you know, sort of at a sort of small number of law schools as permanent legal writing faculty, like they did tremendous work to advocate for that. It is also true that there is still a ways to go. So when I think about status, I think there's sort of two pieces of the puzzle, which, well, I'll say what they are. It's going to be clear that they're closely related, but they're separate, right? One is sort of like the tangible things, right? There's a salary differential at many law schools. You know, do you get research dollars? Do you get voting rights? Do you even get to come to the faculty meetings, right? What kind of job security do you have? Are you on one of these like sort of permanently rotating, like every 2 years you have to prove your worth, which is remarkably inefficient, right? In terms of your use of your time and the law school time having to evaluate you, never mind the sort of equity problems with it. So there's those things. And then there's the culture of the institution, right? In terms of how your non-experiential, your podium colleagues see you, right? In terms of the level of respect they do or don't have for you, do they know you, right? There are schools where like legal writing faculty will say like, they don't even know my name, right? They don't know that I'm on the faculty here. And you know, you can imagine like those things kind of like can push each other forward, right? So like the more respect that, you know, sort of the more people see you just as another colleague as opposed to one of the legal writing colleagues, the more that the status stuff tends to improve, right? And then the more the status tends to improve, the more people will often see you sort of in a more sort of equitable way, right? I mean, just again, you know, when I first started, I wasn't eligible to sit on any committees. Now that might sound blissful to a lot of people, right? Like, wow, you're complaining about that. And fair. And yet, right, it wasn't like, oh, we want to give you a reprieve from having to do committee work. It's you're not real faculty, right? And that means you don't get to know people. You don't get to work with people in areas that are very different from you. And one of the ways that I really have gotten to know people really well on my faculty is by getting stuck on a committee with them for a year that meets, like, you know, every other week and has to dig into some thorny issues. So you know, that's lemonade out of lemons out of committee work. So those things matter a lot. Okay, so why is there the status issue, right? So we can talk a little bit about the history of, you know, sort of where we are. So you have these legal writing programs that sort of like start to blossom, right, 30 years ago, maybe more in some places. And they don't, are, you know, people are, law schools are like, well, we can hire full-time faculty, but we don't want to pay them very much. And, you know, we're not going to really integrate them into the life of the law school. And maybe it'll even be like a part-time job for some people. You know, a lot of people who started taking those jobs were women, mm-hmm. right? So for lots of different reasons, women have been out of the workforce, whatever, things like that. So it is still the case in 2020 that the legal writing profession, the LRW profession, is overwhelmingly female. Like, I think it's 70% of faculty, full-time faculty, are female. Michigan's unusual in this sense. Like, we've always, in the 18 years I've been here, have been split almost evenly. Sometimes it's like 5 men, 4 women, and sometimes it's, you know, the other way around. So, you know, I'm not a labor economist, but I know this, that in fields that are overwhelmingly female, those things, that tends to go hand in hand with power and status differentials and pay differentials and all of those things, for all of the, you know, sort of reasons we can imagine about sort of like a society-wide problem with devaluing work when women do it. So there's that. So then the other thing that I think happens is that, and I when I say I think this happens, I know this happens because I've seen and heard a lot of these conversations play out on Twitter, you know, and in various places and things like that. The sense that, oh, well, but you're, you know, the legal writing faculty aren't as credentialed as we are. They don't do scholarship that's as good as ours. They don't do all of these things, right? Like, maybe, you know, in 2020, it's now like, where's your PhD? Because now everybody has a PhD to get hired, or a VAF at least, right? So I have a couple of thoughts about that and where we are. So there's this idea that, like, well, you are lesser than, and so it's fine to, like, not pay you as much and not to give you the same rights that we have and stuff like that. And I think it kind of comes down to, I mean, so I, you know, we kind of play a thought experiment, right? If we imagine that, like, criminal procedure faculty, right, all of a sudden tomorrow morning, like, the whole world changed and law schools decided that we're not going to pay our crim pro faculty as much. We're not going to give them voting rights. Like, you know, their offices are going to be in the basement. Their offices aren't always in the basement, but maybe their offices are sort of siloed off because they're kind of different from the rest of the faculty. We're not going to support their research, and we're going to give them, oh, also a whole lot of, like, more student-facing work, right? Your students that you have, in addition to teaching them in class, you know, like, they're going to write, like, 2 motions to suppress every semester, and you've got to meet with, right? I mean, you can imagine this world where they, you know, sort of the criminal procedure faculty is viewed as different, and so we're going to not give them the same job kind of, like, benefits that we give to everybody else. If you think ahead, like, that's, you know, 20 years after that, what might criminal procedure faculty look like and what work might they be doing? You know, a couple of things are going to happen. One, you're still going to get lots of people who are passionate about crim pro, and they're still going to enter the profession, and they're still going to want to teach students. They're still going to want to write in the field, but they're going to be hamstrung a little bit in their ability to do it, in some cases quite a bit, right? Because they don't have the same resources. They aren't given the sabbaticals where they can focus on it. They're not integrated into the faculty in a way that makes other people want to engage with them and talk, right? So you're still going to get lots of good scholarship, but it's also going to be, it's probably going to be affected by all of these conditions. The other thing that might happen is some of the people who potentially could be great and superstars are going to look at it and say, I don't know if I want to be a second class citizen, right? In this sort of very hierarchical system. And, you know, what ends up happening, I think, in the legal writing community is that we have lots of people doing amazing scholarship and amazing work on all sorts of things, in spite of the fact that we have some of these status issues. But because the you know, I think some people have it backwards. They think it's okay to treat legal writing faculty differently because they're, even if you think, right, even if we accept that the way we, you know, sort of evaluate podium law professors in the academy generally is the right way, that we're looking at the right basket of credentials and goodies and scholarship, even if you think that that's correct, and even if you think that those standards ought to apply to legal writing faculty also, we have set up a system which is kind of sort of designed to not make it as possible for legal writing faculty to do those same kinds of things, right? If you don't get money for research assistants, sabbaticals, the same salary, if you've got a much heavier teaching load, things like that. And again, it's amazing. I mean, plenty of people still end up producing really outstanding scholarship. So I think there's a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, so it's interesting. This brings up a topic that we've talked about a lot on prior episodes in terms of hiring. And one trend that I've noticed in hiring is that if there's a field that is not thought to be a scholarly, exciting field, schools just won't hire in that area, and they'll get somebody to teach it who's maybe not an expert in it, or they'll get an adjunct. And criminal procedure, I should say, is one of them where I've noticed this happening. I've talked to appointments committees at various schools, just kind of curious who they're looking at, and then. I heard from one.
Yeah, I picked on Crim Pro for a very specific reason, but it wasn't.
it's a really interesting example. So I think there are some schools that sort of won't hire in Crim Pro because they think there's actually not all that much going on, which is wrong. I want to point out. But an answer of an appointments committee in a particular doctrinal field, if they think trusts and estates is another one that sort of That's maybe a better example than criminal procedure, where they'll say, we have trust in estates, we have students take it, but we don't think there's any or very little exciting scholarship going on in trust in estates, so we're not going to hire someone in trust in estates. So they just won't hire someone. Whereas in a legal writing program, there's there's a certain number of 1Ls that are there, it's harder to tell someone who's teaching contracts and torts, maybe, okay, next year you're going to teach in the legal writing program because we need someone and we don't want to hire someone externally. So I guess there is this sort of, it seems to me, this question of fit, where the normal answer in a doctrinal field would be to just not hire in that field. Mm-hmm. And yet in legal writing programs, it's just understood, like, you gotta hire people. Like, this is really, you need to train people in this. And I don't know, is it an answer to look to podium faculty or clinical faculty and try to have them cross into legal writing programs and basically sort of have it unified, not only in terms of status, but actually like unified in the sense of everyone is teaching everything.
Yeah, I don't think that's the answer, right? I think you want people teaching your 1L legal writing students like who are passionate about teaching legal writing, right? I mean, like I tell people, most of my colleagues who teach anything in the legal academy think this way. Like, if I won the lottery, like, I would not quit my job, right? Like, I would continue to teach. Maybe I'd ask for one section instead of two if I had 20 students instead of 40. Like, I could do more with them, right? But I would still want to show up every day. I'd still want to walk into the classroom every day. God willing, I'll be able to walk into the classroom this fall, right? Like, that remains to be seen. We're in a COVID era. I don't know what the longevity of this interview is, but I can
very, very say that. I'll be reading this for what, listening to it for years and years and years.
Right. So I think you want people who are passionate about teaching what they're teaching. Now, we can circle back to what we talked about at the very beginning with sort of the way we teach, sort of the big doctrinal classes, the podium classes, right, with the Socratic cold calling. I should clarify, I loved law school. I loved those classes. Like, my favorite class my first year, one of my two favorite classes was, one was, the professor who was aggressively Socratic. There was an energy to the room. Like, I didn't mind it. Like, I was kind of like, come on, bring it, right? So I come not to bury the Socratic method or the cold call. I actually use some of that myself, but it's one tool. Now, what happens if, my colleague, and we've actually started to do some of this at Michigan, my colleague who teaches Civ Pro says, hey, maybe we should do a little bit of writing in class. Now, for people who've got 80 students, that feels scary because you can't, how are you going to give, feedback to 80 students? But guess what? You've got experts on your faculty, in pedagogy. I've got a whole bunch of ideas and a whole bunch of tools for how you can incorporate that into your class. You want to have your Crim Pro students do a couple of paragraphs of a motion to suppress? Come talk to me. I can help you figure out how to do that. And similarly, one of the things that I do is when I'm really trying to cement those sort of fundamental building blocks of legal analysis in the first couple of weeks, I go to one of my students, either usually contracts or torts professor, And I say, like, what are you teaching this week? Give me the cases. I want to write a hypothetical and I want to pull that into my, I want to come to your class and watch you teach it. And then I want us to work together. I'm going to write a hypothetical for my students to use to really grapple with some of the stuff in class, right? And you should come to my class and watch and like participate and like, let's work together on this. I can only do that if I'm on a faculty where I feel respected, where people know who I am, where I can reach out and say like, come watch me teach, where I have a 7-year contract, right? So like if something goes wrong, because let's face it, like good teaching requires you to take risks and experiment and every once in a while, like things are going to fall flat, right? Like I need all of those things to, and by the way, when I started doing this particular exercise 5 or 6 years ago, the difference in my students' ability to grasp and understand some of those fundamental early concepts like moved ahead by like 2 weeks, right? So I'm now like 2 weeks earlier and being able to say like, now let's do some like much more sophisticated, interesting, fun stuff around narrative and storytelling and, you know, how do you organize a different kind of memo and things like that. So I don't think the answer is like, well, those people should now also be teaching legal writing. It's just more collaboration. And again, I think if you look at the faculties where there is a tremendous sense of respect among people of different hierarchies, because it is a hierarchy, right? I mean, you're always going to have people at the who are at the top of the caste system who are convinced that they're at the top of the caste system solely based on merit. And like the things that got them to the top of the caste system are like, those are the things that we should be evaluating everyone on because I'm so good, right? They are fortunately getting to be fewer and further between, but, you know, all of these different ways to take what we do in legal writing and to, you know, sort of cross-marinate it, I think can be only good for our students.
Great. I wanted to, as the last question, just focus specifically on the question of tenure. So there are a lot of different retention approaches, as you mentioned, short-term contracts, longer-term contracts, formal tenure. Is it important to have tenure? Is tenure versus, you know, 7-year renewal, does it not make that much difference? And maybe it's a culture question where if it's sort of understood, obviously everybody's going to get renewed, that it doesn't matter. But to the extent you can sort of shed light on the choice schools are making when they decide, mm-hmm. should we have a tenured legal writing program, tenure track, or retention of a certain number of years, what guidance would you give?
So I think, I mean, you absolutely need to have a minimum long-term contract, right? For all the reasons I just, you know, sort of said about, you know, academic freedom and experimentation and sort of things like that. And to really also invest in your faculty and to attract really great faculty. Now, whether that's tenure instead of long-term contracts, there are people in the field who feel very strongly about this. You know, one of the things that happens is when people hear tenure, they automatically hear a whole bunch of other things that they think have to go with it. And sometimes there are university rules that require that, right? Like in terms of like salary and sabbaticals and research assistants and things like that. And so when you say tenure, people don't necessarily think, oh, well, I don't know if I want tenure. They think, oh, but there's all these other things that automatically means. You know, my view is that, you know, if you are an institution that is going to insist that your legal writing faculty have to do a job that looks exactly like the podium faculty, then I don't know that it makes, I mean, like, sure, you can go ahead and say it's got to be tenure. I think our job is so different that I wouldn't want to be at an institution that said, oh, in order to advance and in order to keep your job here and to have that job security, you need to do the kind of scholarship that looks like this. Now, some institutions have said, we know that what you do is different, so we're going to tenure you, but we have a different set of standards for it. You know, I'm comfortable at Michigan with my long-term contract. There are certainly things that I want, right? That sort of like, there are plenty of goodies that I think that I would love to see, you know, the institution give to the legal practice program. I think, and there's no faculty, you know, member of any sort of like law school anywhere who doesn't have like their wish list for the dean. I'm no different. My dean knows what my wish list is. You know, but I'm not one of the people who thinks like, you know, tenure or bust. But I can appreciate where those people are coming from, I think is the best way to kind of put it.
Okay, great. Beth, we are unfortunately out of time, but this was an incredibly interesting conversation about a really important part of law school, which I had not yet had featured here. And I was just really excited that you were able to come on and talk about it. It was a great conversation. And thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, lots of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Great.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Legal Academy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us at wherever you rate podcasts. If you'd like to watch a video version of this episode, you can find it on YouTube at channel The Legal Academy. Finally, you can also follow us on Twitter at The Legal Academy. Thank you.